Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And as you've come to expect, we tape our show on Tuesday afternoon in order for you to hear it on Wednesday, both locally and on the Pacifica Network. So forgive me in case something happens about farming and pregnancy. I can't share it with you if it's happening on Wednesday. But before we begin our show, I do this every single day. I will do this every single day between now and November of 2020. It is the voice of Colonel Vindman. Colonel Vindman testified before the impeachment hearings in November of 2019. His testimony riveted everyone in the room. It riveted everyone in the United States. And the words that he used where he said, "Don't worry, Dad, it will be okay," are words I want to embroider on a pillow so I can look at them every night and say, "Oh God, Colonel Vindman, it's not okay for you and it's not okay for us." So please pay attention to the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right. So this show is a typical attitude show. We're doing farming. We're doing COVID. We're doing pregnancy. You know, we do a whole potpourri of things. But this show is actually not only important, I think, for us to have as a conversation nationally, but it's important to me personally. Our first conversation is about local farmers. It's about farmers markets. It's about buying produce from local farmers. And many of you may have heard me say this before, but my youngest daughter has been an organic farmer. She was trained to be an organic farmer. She worked on organic farms in Vermont. She actually works at a small local food co-op that basically is supplied by local farmers. So I saw this and I went, I have to do this story. But then again, I've had every organic farmer at my house for the last 4 years because they have their cocktail party after their annual meeting. I don't think they do cocktails, but anyway. So that's that story. And then the second story is about pregnancy during the time of COVID-19. And my oldest daughter lives in Shanghai and my oldest daughter is pregnant. So these are two stories that are personal to me. So let's begin with theconversation.com. I love this site. I mine this site virtually every single day because it brings me some of the best experts on the planet. They write these fabulous pieces that are kind of magazine-y format, so they're easy to understand. And normally you go to a place where a reporter will be interviewing these professors or these PhDs and then writing what they learn. What's wonderful about theconversation.com is they actually go to the source, and then the source writes the piece. So joining us right now is Tamra Benjamin. She is an assistant program leader and in diversified farming and food systems at Purdue University. And what caught my eye was the title of her piece at theconversation.com. Coronavirus fears over farmers' markets could hit new growers hard, just when Americans need them most. We have a local farmers' market literally three blocks from my house. Every Saturday morning, starting in late spring, we all sort of trek down. It's both a place to buy locally produced food and honey and products and plants, but it's also a place where people congregate. So it plays such an economic, social, and sustainable role in our lives. And I saw that and I went, oh my God, how do you do a farmer's market? And then I said, oh my God, we're worried about our food supply. And a lot of these people are living on a shoestring in order to give us our meat, our vegetables, our fruits. What happens when one of their sources, a farmer's market, may not be viable at the time of COVID-19? So Professor Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us. And I just want to let the audience know that when you go to our page, The Attitude, on our Facebook page, you will see not only this article from her piece at The Conversation, you will see a whole series of articles that literally deal with everything. With a, let me just give you an example of one of the titles, A Consumer Guide to Buying from Local Farmers During the COVID-19 Outbreak. And then she has a farmer's guide to basically producing during the time of COVID-19. So absolutely every chapter and verse about this topic is described because of Professor Benjamin and the team that she works with. And more importantly, we're gonna make sure that it's at the Attitudes Facebook page. So you can download it, you can read it, you can share it with people in your state, in your community, because we need these farmers probably now more than ever. And if you don't understand why, this will help. And if you don't figure out how to support them, they will disappear. Professor Benjamin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Really appreciate you inviting me.
Well, it's great. So let's start with how your piece at The Conversation begins, because in some ways, that's the entree to all the other pieces that you sent me. And you talked about, so how do these locally produced farmers, a lot of them very young, a lot of them new to the field, how do they figure out how to respond given that we can't congregate in the same way? And how do I, as a consumer, figure out how to sustain them?
So what I think is really interesting is that farmers markets were set up as a way to integrate farming to consumers. It was a way to match where your food was coming from. So if you look at a farmer's market, and a really good farmer's market, it was where there was a lot of interacting going on. There was engagement. There were people talking to each other. You were learning who your farmer was. And now with COVID-19, that all is thrown out the window, because we all know that social distancing is what's going to stop this, is what's going to actually curb the escalation of incidences and deaths. And so we knew right from the beginning we had to, and because we were coming into farmers market season, we knew we were going to have to do a 180 degree turn and figure out how to get food to people, mm-hmm. and how to get the supply as well. I mean, we have a supply. We have people already planting. They've already been planning to plant since January, December. They've already been in the fields getting stuff in their high tunnels. They're harvesting. And so there was a real concern of both there's going to be a demand and there's going to be a supply, and there was going to be no path in between those.
So you're actually writing this piece because in some ways, let's think of this as a bridge. Yeah. And what you're figuring out is, how do I build this bridge so that what is already being planted and people that already want it are going to be able to somehow access it and yet stay safe?
That was my goal. Our goal, and that wasn't just mine. It was, we have an amazing team. I don't work by myself. I work definitely in a team community. And the idea was, we all were kind of seeing the same picture. How do we build that bridge for farmers, but not just for farmers? How do we build that bridge for a consumer? Because you and I go to the grocery store and all of a sudden we're not finding things that we want. And we've never really gone through that, at least my generation. I'm, you know, Gen X, I've never gone through that, where I've walked into a grocery store and everything hasn't been on the shelf. And, you know, maybe my grandparents or even my mom has seen some of that, but in reality, we have an entire generation, you know, multiple generations that have never dealt with walking into a grocery store and the shelves being empty. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that our food system is completely crashed, but I am saying we have farmers here that can supply the demands that we want. And so when I hear that there aren't any eggs in the grocery store, I know four or five farmers just in 10 miles from here that have eggs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's interesting about this is that, you know, I have a lot of friends who are locavores. I mean, they don't want to buy anything that doesn't come within maybe 40 miles of where they live, or even 100 miles of where they live. I'll give them a bigger. And yet, but what that means is that they have learned to adjust to not having the same choices that they have. But what I got a sense of from having read your piece and some of the other pieces that you sent me from Purdue is that this is actually a national security issue as well. Because what we're gonna find out is it safe to have things being trucked across the country? Are there gonna be truckers that are gonna be healthy enough to do it? have we figured out a relationship with our big grocery chains that maybe they won't have the variety, but maybe if they buy locally, they will be sustaining these people. There'll be things on their shelves, and while it won't be a farmer's market, if we know how to behave going into a grocery store, now we go at certain hours, now we go at certain times, we can actually social distance more than you could at a farmer's market. What you might have is a whole new relationship being created that didn't exist before this. And that new relationship could be good for everyone.
Yeah, and I think there's, it's twofold. I think you can design a farmer's market to meet the requirements of dealing with COVID-19. You can space the booths out more. You can have a one kind of track. You walk into the farmer's market one way and you walk out the other side so that there isn't intermingling going on. You can, you know, control the number of people that go in. There are lots of ways that we can do that that I think we aren't even doing in grocery stores right now. So I think, you know, that's the first thing. I don't think we should be shutting down farmers markets. I think you can find protocols and regulations for what's going on this year to make sure that we can reduce some of that possible contamination. And then in a grocery store, you know, it's really interesting. You try as a small scale farmer to get your carrots into the grocery store. There are places where it's 16 different steps that you have to go through. For instance, you have to have your stuff on a pallet that some pallet master has decided is sufficient or enough. So any person that has a small scale farm, organic, you know, all of these things, the hoops that have to be jumped through in order to get into a large grocery store is nearly impossible. So until those grocery stores start feeling the pressure of they don't have carrots, then they may actually start to lax some of those issues and say, look, we just want to make sure you have good agricultural practices, you're following food safety regulations, which every farmer in Indiana, we have, it doesn't matter if they're small or large, we have been pushing with them to get food safety standards on their farms.
Ken, so, let me get Ken wants to ask a question. Ken, yep.
I was just going to add to what both of you said last. Tamara, you're just talking about having to put it on pallets and jump through all these hoops in order to even sell your locally grown products in a grocery store. And Arnie was talking about trucking it across the country and everything. Both of those things have another issue that we need to worry about. And that is that, you know, the truckers touch the groceries as they come. Who knows how many people were involved in loading up the truck and unloading the truck. The pallets that you're talking about, they're special pallets. You know, how many people that work who knows where for the grocery store or at some delivery company delivered those pallets to whoever gets them. And you're a lot safer actually buying in a local market, I would think, where everybody knows everybody who has touched anything related to these products. And so you at least have some chance of avoiding getting contaminated.
Well, yeah, there's a really good graphic about that where it shows how many different people touched it when it got to the grocery store in comparison, how many people touched it and got to the farmer's market.
Send me that graphic. Send me that graphic. I will post it on Facebook. Send me that graphic. But that is so important. What I'm trying to figure out is, as you have been sort of now reimagining 180 degree difference because of COVID-19. So all our behaviors are going to have to change. What I'm trying to also figure out is you've put together sort of almost a guide as to what consumers should be thinking about, how they should be purchasing, what farmers should be thinking about, how they should be purchasing. What I'm trying to figure out is, have you reached out to all the commissioners of agriculture in all the 50 states? Because in some ways, we're now on Zoom, so you and I can see each other. I almost think that they need to organize some kind of a Zoom meeting or some kind of a group meeting where they can start talking with the grocers about what it is they need and what it is they want. Talking with the farmers about it and saying, you need to establish new relationships because the old relationships may not be there. And I want to assist you in establishing these new relationships. Have you started talking to all these commissioners of agriculture and saying, how are you thinking about COVID-19? Here's what we've done at Purdue. And Purdue, we've already started not only thinking about it, but giving guidelines to it. I want to share this with you. And I think you need to then carry it to your farmers and to your grocers.
So that's a really good question. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to have the answer that you want to hear. Part of the problem that we have is we have 50 independent states, and each state has a Department of Agriculture and has a Department of Health. And I may have a little bit of influence over the Department of Agriculture because I know people there. I can let them know here are some good protocols or some good regulations. But ultimately, it's not agriculture that makes these decisions. It's actually the Department of Health. And so, and then within Indiana, it's not even the state Department of Health, it's county health boards that make decisions, for instance, about farmers markets. So now you went from one Department of Health down to 92 different counties in Indiana. So it's pretty complicated. I hear what you're saying. I agree with you. I think it would be great if we could all unify and start to work together like that. But I think the realities are pretty daunting just here within one state to get everyone to agree on, you know, keeping farmers markets open, for instance, and what are the protocols that it looks like.
Okay, so let's suggest that the farmers market isn't going to be the reality, that they just may make a blanket mm-hmm. statement. It may not be an informed yeah. one, but it's a blanket statement.
Right, right.
So now what I have is, and what I've read from your stuff, and it made me think, of course, this is true. Most of the money that is spent by these young farmers, and most of them are younger. They're younger than the traditional farmers. They haven't yes. been around for a long time. So they're both new to this. They're probably in debt, much more so yep. than older farmers.
Correct.
They may benefit from some of the bailouts, but I'm not quite sure how much.
I've heard that they're not going to be.
Well,
so I don't know if that's the case or not. I have to look into it.
Well, then you better call Joni Ernst in Iowa. You better call all those Midwestern senators and start screaming at the next bailout bill. But as I'm looking at this—
Amy Klobuchar might be—
yeah, Amy Klobuchar, exactly. So as I'm looking at this—
For Minnesota.
Yeah, Minnesota. So what I'm thinking is that, so how can we have a relationship between the person who wants to buy and the person who wants to grow? So I know that there are things right now that we're doing where there's a direct relationship. You yeah. buy a share, you do whatever, but we may need to expand that concept because we may be in COVID-19, I think, for months. I think maybe for about yeah. 8 months, to be honest with you, if not a year. And that means that I think people who've never done this before need the tools, and farmers who have never done this before need to become more acquainted with a much broader audience.
So there's a couple really interesting things that are happening, and they've already started to happen within the last week, 2 weeks. For instance, there are online platforms, they're kind of like food hubs, where you can go and you can buy directly from farmers, and then they deliver to delivering places. And there's one here in Indiana called Market Wagon. They went from 400 orders to over 850 orders in one weekend.
Oh my God.
So you know, they have, and they're probably continuing. I haven't talked to them again since then, but you know, that's the reality. Anyone that I've talked to, all these younger farmers, they're very astute online. They're all getting their stuff online. They're signing up for online deliveries, figuring out how to deliver their stuff. So it's reducing any kind of contact with people. Here is the cool thing about this. We have younger farmers that may be less experienced when it comes to farming, but they have a lot of experience when it comes to doing online and internet. My biggest concern right now are those farmers like the Amish that don't have that connectivity. So what do we do with those farmers? What do we do with farmers who, you know, they barely have a telephone?
I've got it. You ready? You know how, no, listen to this. I'm crazy, but I've got it. You know how they have a brother, sister, a big brother, a big sister program?
Uh-huh.
You give the Amish a big farmer, little farmer, like Amish farmer
there
program.
There you go.
And what you, no, I'm dead serious about this. What you do is you pair someone to work with them. And
yeah.
and that way they can still maintain the integrity of who they are as the Amish.
Yeah.
But given what they need, they're going to need to somehow be able to create a communication connection that's different. And maybe that's a way to connect, you know, the more sophisticated Amish farmer with the young, less sophisticated, but very sort of social media savvy younger farmer. And that's yeah. a way for them to do it. One could write a note and the other one could put it on social media.
Yeah,
and that way everyone's integrity is respected.
Actually, one of the women that I work with, and she's one of the authors on there, she's the head of Indiana Grown, which is our Department of Agriculture kind of website where you can meet farmers and match with farmers. And she was actually posting what all this one Amish grower had. So it was kind of like what you're saying, but it's going to take that. It's going to take community. It's going to take, you know, it's a village kind of thing in order to help all of these different local farmers survive.
But you know what I love about this? Yeah, go on, Ken.
If I could just add, there are and always have been for 100 years at least farmers co-ops. They do work together. My father-in-law, who's a dairy farmer and far from Amish, by the way, but he was the chair of the local Grange, the farmer's Grange, and they would share, you know, buying grain to feed the cows and buying seed to grow crops and whatever. And he'd go out and bring a big truck and then he'd distribute it to all the little farmers. But they've been cooperating for years, especially in the Midwest.
I think it's going to take that. It's going to take cooperation. It's going to be take community building. It's going to take networking. You know, our farms, they used to all talk to each other. They shared what they were doing. They talked about the weather. They'd sit at the coffee shop and, you know, shoot the breeze about whatever it was that has to do with farming. We lost that. We lost that when we have gone into this large scale commercialized farming, industrial farming that we have now. It's everyone cutthroat for themselves. People don't share their secrets. They don't talk about the seeds that they used or what kind of fertilizer they used. We've lost that community. We've lost that kind of close-knit social fabric, and we have to get it back. And I think, fortunately, the internet helps us to get that back somewhat, but we still need to do things where we're connecting with people in other ways.
Isn't it interesting that COVID-19 is about social distancing, but in a bizarre way, we may back into creating community again.
I hope
and
so.
I've been thinking a lot about this, and my daughter was out in Oregon for a little bit, and they were worried about the earthquake. You know, that remember that big thing? It's common, trust me. You know, if they've got COVID-19 and they may have an earthquake. But one of the things that was so exciting about these big meetings that they were holding when she was out there was that they were talking about what is old is new again. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about canning, and they were talking about root cellars, and they were talking about what you could grow, and they were talking about, you know, sustainable energy, and in a lot of ways, everyone went in scared talking about the earthquake, and everybody left going, that person knows how to do this, that person knows how to do that, and it changed the emotional response. Mm-hmm. And even though we're talking social distancing, what I'm hearing from you is that the series of articles that you've written, and again, everyone, they'll be at the Attitudes Facebook page, it will not just be the conversation.com article, but at least four other articles that I think you need to share. But I think it's a real opportunity, and the one thing I want you to mention before I let you go, Professor Benjamin, is the idea of this is a national security story as well, because I think that's the other piece, is that you want local farms. You want farmers to do well. It's not that you're not going to buy something from Mexico and you're not going to buy something from China. You're not going to, I mean, all the apples come from China now because, you know, whatever. But it may turn out that just the way we don't make anything anymore, we need to grow things again. So can you talk a little bit about this? Because I think this is so critical.
Yeah, my husband's from Costa Rica. And when we moved back here in 2012, he thought it was absolutely crazy that we were mowing a lawn. And he ripped up the entire front yard of our house. And we live right in the middle of West Lafayette. And I was like, for sure, the police were going to come by and tell us we couldn't be growing tomatoes and raspberry bushes and things like that in our front yard. And lo and behold, it became one of the cornerstones of our community. Kids would walk by when I was digging out potatoes and saying, what's that? And couldn't believe that the potato came from the, you know, from the soil. And, you know, lo and behold, today I'm finally not the laughing stock of the neighborhood, right? I have what I call a corona garden, just like the Victory Gardens. What happened during World War II? Everyone stopped and thought about how are they going to produce their own food? And what could they do to be patriotic and to be part of the movement? Well, this is a great way to do it. Plant some tomato seeds, you know, plant a few beans, do something where you are reconnecting with the earth. But, you know, when you say, is this a national security issue? Yeah, I do believe that. I believe that we should be figuring out how to produce food that is closer to our home and we need to be figuring out how to eat seasonally. You know, right now, we should not be eating strawberries. We're going to be you know, going crazy with strawberries in a month or two. But right now is not the time to be eating strawberries. We've just gotten into this habit that whatever is there, that's what we eat in the grocery store. And in reality, right now is the time to be eating kale. I have 5 bags of kale in my refrigerator from my local farmer. I have, you know, radishes. I have all these cold season vegetables. That's what you should be eating. But that's hard. You know, that's one of the challenges that we have. Just like we're all having cabin fever right now, one of the things is how do we start to learn how to can or freeze or do things that will protect our food supply into the future.
So I let me just remind everyone, we're talking with
Tamara
Benjamin. She's an assistant now, program leader at Diversified Farming and Food Systems at Purdue University. Let me just give you 3 titles. The title of her piece at theconversation.com, Coronavirus Fears Over Farmers Markets Could Hit New Growers Hard, Just When Americans Need Them Most. And then just 2 of the 4 articles that I also have posted at the Facebook page, Food, A Consumer Guide to Buying from Local Farmers During the COVID-19 Outbreak, and Agriculture, A Guide for Local Producers to Navigate the COVID-19 Outbreak. We do it all on The Attitude. And you know what? You're coming back. I can tell. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And we're going to have to rethink a lot of things. But you know what? Out of this fear may come some really positive change. And I'm just hoping that we were there to help. So thank you so much.
I'm very, very thankful that you wanted to talk to me. Take care and have a great rest of your day.
Okay.
Thanks,
A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1870. That was the day the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was adopted. It was the 3rd of the Reconstruction Amendments. It prohibited voting restrictions on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Premier historian Eric Foner states that the Reconstruction Amendments reflected, quote, a newly empowered national state and the idea of a national citizenry enjoying equality before the law. These legal changes also arose from the militant demands for equal rights from former slaves themselves. The bulk of Southern states refused to ratify, but then capitulated. Interestingly, New York sought and failed to revoke its earlier ratification. The amendment split the women's suffrage movement for its failure to codify women's voting rights. Some radical Republicans also abstained on the basis that it did not also prohibit poll taxes and literacy tests. Immediately, the 15th Amendment came under attack. The Ku Klux Klan terrorized black voters and Reconstruction governments for years. One of the most extreme examples was the 1873 Colfax Massacre. After the Compromise of 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes refused to enforce civil rights protections. The rise of discriminatory Jim Crow laws effectively disenfranchised Southern blacks for nearly a century. Congress would finally enforce the 15th Amendment fully through the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. However, the act has come under attack most recently, as in the 2013 case, Shelby v. Holder. Jurisdictions with histories of voter restrictions no longer have to obtain preclearance before implementing changes to voting laws and practices. Over 150 years after the end of the Civil War, African Americans are still fighting to protect their right to vote. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Save the world.
That's destined to
that
die.
That is destined to die.
When I look at the world.
When I look at the world,
it fills me with sorrow.
It fills me with sorrow.
Little children today.
Children today.
Really gonna suffer tomorrow.
Really suffer tomorrow.
Oh, what a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to
Such
live.
Such a bad way to live.
Oh, who is to blame?
Who is to blame?
We can't stop
when
living.
When we can't stop living. Oh, oh.
Live.
Live.
Live your life.
live for life. Life.
But let live, everybody.
Live life for the children.
Live life for the children. Oh, for the children.
You see, let's save the children. Let's save all the children.
Save the babies. Save the babies. And if you want them, you got them. Save the babies. Oh, the feel you got feeling. You will save the babies. All of the children.
Welcome back to Part 2 of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the two stories that we're doing today, one on local farming and the other one about being pregnant during the time of COVID-19, that these stories I think are important for us to have as a national conversation, but they're very personal for me. And as many of you know, my daughter lives in Shanghai. She was trying to get pregnant for 6 years. They just decided to adopt a baby from Wuhan because of what happened because of COVID-19. And just as they were about to sort of file the paperwork, she finally gets pregnant in the middle of COVID-19. So I was, when she called me, I have to tell you, I wasn't elated. I was terrified. I was terrified. And then of course I went to ProPublica, which again, another site that we adore. And we go there and mine it for information because they give us great content and fabulous reporters. The piece that grabbed my eye was the following. They didn't have coronavirus symptoms until after they gave birth. Then they tested positive. Joining me is Nina Martin. She writes for ProPublica, but let me give you a little bit of her background because I think her background is just incredibly powerful. She covers sex and gender issues for ProPublica. She joined the staff in 2013 after spending much of the last decade at San Francisco Magazine as articles editor since 2007 and an executive editor. She has been a reporter and editor specializing in women's legal and health issues for more than 30 years. And she's written for everyone. And she also writes for my favorite, ProPublica. So let's talk about this piece because I want you to, and I want you to tell the details about it because as you hear the details of who she was, why she came to the hospital, but also who she exposed and everybody was so shocked by, I think it gives us all pause when we realize how many women will be coming to the hospital to deliver and that now with COVID-19, everybody needs to think differently.
Right. Well, first of all, Arnie, thank you so much for that very nice introduction and for inviting me on today.
Welcome.
I have covered maternal health at ProPublica for the last several years, and I have been pivoting to coverage of coronavirus because it turns out that there's a lot of there are a lot of implications for pregnant women and new mothers of coronavirus. I think that the report that you refer to is one of the very first reports that's been published in the U.S. about coronavirus and pregnancy in the U.S. So far, most of the data that we have is from China, and there's not that much of that yet that's been published either. So these are seven cases that came to the New York Presbyterian healthcare system, hospital system in New York City in the space of a very few days. I was literally on the phone with somebody on the 18th of March for another story I've written about coronavirus. And at that point, she said, we don't have any cases in our hospital. And so by the next day, they had two. What makes the cases, so there were seven women who came to the, who've been at the hospital at least as of the publication of this study, which was rushed into publication last Friday.
Oh my God.
Four of those women, so four out of the seven women who had coronavirus while they were pregnant ended up in the hospital. two of those women ended up in intensive care. And what's kind of important about that was that the two women who ended up in intensive care were both women who showed up at the hospital not knowing that they had coronavirus. They had asymptomatic coronavirus. It was not until after they delivered their babies that they started to show symptoms that made doctors really concerned, that made the doctors decide to test them. And at that point, they were found to have coronavirus. And, you know, in both of these cases, these two women showed up at the hospital. They were tested. They were given the test that is typical of many hospitals and providers, which is that they had their thermometers, their temperatures were taken. They were asked about their symptoms. These women did not have any COVID-19 symptoms. So they didn't have fever, they didn't have cough, they didn't have shortness of breath, they didn't have sore throat. They brought their partners with them. Their partner said the same thing. In the case of one woman, when she was her temperature was taken, it was actually below normal. So in the course of being treated, these women ended up exposing each of them at least 15 obstetric providers. So doctors, nurses, support staff. And that is very concerning for a couple of reasons. For the obvious reason, we don't want our doctors are in incredibly short supply, and you know, on the front lines, they're very precious resource, even more than ever. But OB providers actually are particularly particularly precious resource at the moment, because there's so many pregnant women who are going to be giving birth in this country over the next 3 months. Somewhere around 1 million women will be having about 1 million babies around the US in the next few months. And OB providers are highly specialized. In a lot of ways, they are the most specialized practitioners. And so when we lose OB providers, we can't easily replace them with providers from other parts of the hospital system. You can't have an ER nurse come in and suddenly become a labor and delivery nurse. You can't have an orthopedic surgeon suddenly come in and, you know, and be a high risk pregnancy doc. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, of course, is that OB providers in some ways may be among the most at risk for getting COVID.
Why?
Because of, well, as it turns out, there are a lot of asymptomatic women in New York City and probably elsewhere who have the virus. But also because of, if you think about what happens when a woman is giving birth and the way that her providers are ideally tending to her, there's a lot of screaming and yelling and secretions and aerosol droplets and things.
That's right. Are you reminding me of my two babies? Thank you so much. No, so I didn't give you that knuckle sandwich. Right. Oh my God.
Yeah. So there's just a lot more there's a lot of exposure. You know, we think about, I think that we think about the ER as being the place where many of the exposures have sort of been happening, and that's been true. But, you know, in some ways, suddenly showing, you know, having a baby say, it's time, I'm coming, is also an urgent situation, if not an emergency. It's an urgent situation because you can't stop it. So that's why ER doctors, and that's why this report was concerning to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons.
So Nina, God, honest to God, your piece was incredibly well written, terrifying completely for me as I'm reading it. And what was interesting though was this woman who came in, the one that you described, the 38-year-old mother, the reason she was in a hospital was that she was having an induced labor. She was already type 2 diabetes, she had a liver condition, all those things that would make her a person who, God help her, if she got COVID-19 and wasn't pregnant because she had all those underlying conditions. Right. So for her to come into a hospital and not exhibit any of those things, to be induced for labor, and then suddenly have, I mean, she crashed right afterwards. Crashed. It's incredible what happened to her after she delivered. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, what are they looking at protocols now that this story has come out, now that we understand that even this woman, who probably, for the most part, I would have thought she would have been able to sort of exhibit some kind of behavior before she came in to be induced, but it turns out she didn't, but it became obvious right after the fact. We know that we keep hearing testing, 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 testing. Right. It sounds to me like virtually every pregnant woman should be tested in that 45-minute or 15-minute turnaround test before she comes into a hospital, that nobody, no coaches, no husband, no mother can go in with her, that she has to sort of go in alone, which is so, so sad. Mm-hmm. But that in order to protect this incredible group of vital staff people and to keep the integrity of the OBGYN unit, it's almost like they are crucial for testing in some ways, more so than the people who they think have COVID-19.
Well, so I think that there's a lot of really, there's a lot of complicated issues that you sort of raised there.
Right, exactly.
The first is that I think it's probably true, and this is what I'm hearing from doctors, that despite these scary cases that have started to emerge, they're probably we don't actually know how many women who are pregnant and have COVID-19 virus have very mild cases of the disease. And so we just don't know that. There haven't been enough. And, you know, so we're hearing kind of the scary worst case scenarios, which it's very important to know about if you're a provider and if you're a woman. But we don't actually know whether we don't think this is true for most women. There have been a lot of, since then, a lot of anecdotal reports that I'm hearing from my doctor and medical sources that they're seeing women who are relatively asymptomatic or who have relatively mild COVID who are pregnant. So that's important to know, that you're not going to, just because you're going to get COVID and you're pregnant, you're going to crash out the way happened with these two women.
Right, right. And
very
and
important.
Right. And no, I understand that.
Sure, right.
And what I'm concerned about is not that you're, you know, asymptomatic or you have a very mild case of COVID, is that you're coming into a unit that's not designed for COVID, that's designed for delivery of babies.
Right.
And that, so even if the mama is fine and even if the baby is fine, maybe the OBGYN may not be fine or maybe the nurse may not be fine because they may then get the disease. So this is not just about those people that crash, like these horrific stories that you shared, but also about the fact that in some ways, maybe the thing that's more frightening is the person that doesn't exhibit anything. We don't have sufficient testing and nobody knows, even after she delivers, that she was COVID-19 positive. Only
exactly.
When the mother, the person that's delivering the baby, that contracts it, and it turns out that it was this mother that delivered the COVID-19, not just the baby.
Right. So one of the things that's happened in New York very quickly after this hospital system started seeing these cases is that they made a decision that has been really controversial. And they'd made the decision to ban all support persons for women coming into labor. Or coming in to deliver a baby in that hospital system. So this was New York Presbyterian Hospital System, the Mount Sinai Hospital System followed suit very quickly afterwards. This was on March 22nd. And so basically what that means was that they determined that if you were going to give birth in one of those hospitals and you could not have your spouse, you couldn't have your mother, you couldn't have your sister, you couldn't have a friend, you couldn't have a doula. You had to go in there and give birth by yourself. And then you had to take care of that baby by yourself for as long as you were in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And this was going to affect potentially a lot of women in the New York City area. Those two hospital systems, Mount Sinai and New York Presbyterian account for almost a third of all babies, or more than a third, actually, of all babies born in New York City every year. They also, it caused a lot of ripple effects throughout the region. Some other hospitals started to say, well, maybe we should do the same thing too. Women were suddenly freaking out, as you can imagine, and saying, I'm going to go to New Jersey. I'm going to go to Connecticut. I'm going to go to a different hospital to deliver my baby. I'm going to have a home birth. And so what ended up happening was that there was a huge amount of controversy and consternation about that decision and how that decision was made. It was made by the doctors, by the healthcare systems, because they were really concerned about their doctors, their patients, babies and mothers, and, you know, other patients in the hospital system. And so it was really understandable that they wanted to protect everybody. But there was a really major pushback. And so on Friday night, Saturday, Governor Cuomo stepped in and his people and said, no, we have looked at this and we have determined that every hospital in New York State must allow women to have at least one healthy support person in the birthing room with her if she wants it. And that person is entitled to stay for the immediate postpartum period, which is not very long, but at least it's some support can happen. And then babies and pediatric patients are also entitled to have that kind of support system.
Okay, and Nina, I got to push back, and I'm not pushing back, but I'm curious. So I understand what Andrew did. You know, Governor Cuomo mm-hmm. is now sort of our not real president. So in a lot of ways, he's not addressing New York and establishing a pattern for New York. He's also sort of telescoping to the other 49 states because we're actually turning to him more for leadership than we are to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So I hear this. So let me just ask a question. How do you know that your partner is clean? How do you know that your partner doesn't have COVID-19? How do you know that your doula doesn't have COVID-19? So I hear what he says, but the only way you can prove that, Nina, is if they're tested. And the problem is we don't have requisite tests. How do you get the test? You can wait 7 days for the test, but no baby's going to wait 7 days because once they're, you know, coming down the tube, they're coming out. So what I'm trying to figure out is, I love what he said. How mm-hmm. the frick do you prove it, Nina?
Well, I don't know that you can prove it. I think that you're right, that they're not very good testing still in many parts of the country. And New York City is one of those places. But here's the issue. Think first of all, if most women are coming in with at this point with their partners or with a close relative,
of course
those people are already hanging out with each other. Those people have already infected each other. Right. So the chances of you coming in with somebody, especially if you're coming in with somebody you live with, who hasn't already been, you know, breathing the same air and so forth is minimal. We're probably talking about, and in fact, I was talking to doctors in New Jersey over the weekend who said that they're, you know, trying to think about what to do about this. And they are thinking about treating the patient, the woman who comes in, and her partner as a single unit and sort of treating them the same way, because the assumption is that whoever she brings in with her is really necessary for support and that they should treat the two of them in as if they were a unit of one, rather than trying to pretend that the support person is not the same as, you know, I think
that's fair. I understand having delivered two babies with my spouse in attendance. You're going to love this where they talked about taking care of it. I'll never forget this with my first daughter. I'm at a little tiny hospital up in northern New Hampshire called Cottage Hospital. A lot of hospitals in America are like Cottage Hospital. Mm-hmm. That's really the name of the hospital. And the nurse comes in, I deliver the baby, and she says, would you like to learn to bathe the baby? And I looked at my husband and I said, nope, that's his job. I said, I'm going to be doing the breastfeeding. I'm probably going to be doing most of the changing. This is what he learns from the get-go. And the nurse looked at me like, I said, you know what? This is my other half. And mm-hmm. so in a lot of ways, what you're describing is exactly what I sort of told that nurse and that doctor was that we are a unit. We are. Right. I am not a one. This is not, asexual reproduction here. And so therefore, if you're talking to us about this baby, you are talking to us. You're not talking to me. Ken, I know you want to weigh in.
Yeah, I just want to add in another side to the picture, which I think must at least be considered. I don't know if it outweighs some of the other considerations, but that is, you're all talking about the mother and the support person as how much risk are they going to be, but also, and it's not just, the doctors and nurses and support people who come in to deal directly with the birth, but hospitals are kind of close places. They're not, everybody's not 6 feet apart. So in order to get to my hospital room or Arnie's hospital bed, she's a woman, they've got to go past 12 other nurses and the nurse's station and all of that. And then the partner, the support person, at least the mother is in bed and she's not going anywhere. But when I'm in the hospital helping a loved one, I walk around, I go get them some water, I go to the bathroom, and each time the partner or the support person walks in and out and walks by the nurse's station and up and down the halls, there's more risk of more people being infected by whatever liquid they have on them.
You're right. And so one of the things that every hospital in the country has done and already is basically ban people from doing exactly that. They basically banned all visitors from hospitals. So if you're an adult and you are in a hospital right now, for whatever reason, you go in for cancer treatment, you go in for COVID, you go in for an appendectomy, you're going in by yourself. You're not going to have any visitors. You're not going to have any help. The only question is whether there should be some exceptions in certain instances. And the state of New York has decided pediatric patients are an exception. They do need a support. You don't want to just leave your 5-year-old child in the hospital without all by themselves to be cared for by total strangers. That's right. Not going to be good for anybody. And they've also determined that a woman who is giving birth to a new life is also support is medically essential. And I think that, but that support person, whoever it is also extremely limited. So that person basically is only allowed to come in with that woman. That person is not allowed to go get any food or leave the room or go home and take a shower and come back. Basically, you're in there and you are stuck until you leave or 2 hours after the delivery, whichever comes first. Over the weekend, I was in contact with a lot of people who either had recently given birth and had done so without support, or they were looking forward to what was going to happen. And the kinds of people that I was talking to were people who had C-sections, for example. If you have a C-section, that's major surgery. You're in the hospital for 4 days, and the idea that you should have to take care of a baby after having, maybe the reason why you had the C-section is you nearly died. Right. The idea that you're supposed to take care of that baby then after having gone through that by yourself is frankly a little bit crazy. It's not so good for the baby. It's much less for the mom. I'm talking to people who are having twins. Imagine going into a hospital to have twins and being not being able to have any support person while you're there during labor and delivery, but then having to take care of twins by yourself as a new mother who's just had a C-section. Can't imagine anything worse. And so I think that it's those kinds of situations, triplets maybe, right? It's those kinds of situations that really made people sort of stand back and say, whoa, this is a problem. And it's important to note that the public hospitals in New York City did not change their policy. And that's because public hospitals in New York City understand that with the patients that they serve, having a support person there is not just incredibly important for that woman, it's also incredibly important to support the medical team, because somebody's got to watch that woman while and that baby. And if it's not going to be a husband or a mother or a sister or a doula, it's going to be a nurse, it's going to be a doctor, and they're busy. They're too busy by themselves as it is. The other issue that I want to sort of, I've thought about a lot over the weekend because I've been following a lot of changes, a lot of things that are happening in the States around sex and gender issues around COVID. And one thing that keeps happening over and over again is women, is really basic reproductive care. And what we have sort of thought about as being basic, depending on where you live, basic reproductive rights are kind of being, we're overridden by COVID. So women are being told, well, you can't have the birth control that you want. You can't get, you know, because of COVID, that's a procedure. You can't have that procedure. Yeah, that might be the only thing that's going to work for you. Too bad. You've got to deal with what you can only have a certain kind of birth control. Oh, you can't have an abortion if you live in, you know, states in the South that are trying to say that that abortion should not be considered essential health care. You can't, if you are in the middle of fertility treatments, oh, too bad. You might have spent a lot of money and gotten your body all
ready. Nina Martin, I have to let you go. I want to keep you on for 3 hours. So here's the deal, Nina. This is just the beginning of the conversation. Everything you've told me said, on March 18th, they did this. On the 22nd, they did this. On Friday, they did this. It's only, you know, we're taping this on March 31st. We're only at the beginning. So you have to promise me that you will join me again. I think in another month, we will know a lot more. Yeah. In another month, we'll know a lot more about a lot of things dealing with women's health. And I have a funny feeling you're going to be our go-to person. Nina Martin, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for ProPublica hiring you. And you are a great resource. So thank you
so much for having me. And good luck. And I hope you and your loved ones can stay safe.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Thank you so
take
much.
Care.
Please stop those numbers from climbing, Nina.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Stay my best. Thank you so much. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson.
Okay.
I'm Ken Barnes.
Bye.
We will talk with you tomorrow. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Them that's got shall get. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money, you've got lots of friends crowding round the door. Spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.